Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in New Basement Studios by the lake, a slightly delayed our famous New Year's resolution show.
Oh, I don't know if it's... I think sometimes we've been really delayed. I mean, okay. In past years, remember I had to press you one of the years to make a resolution, and we kind of bounced around it for episodes until you finally did.
I don't think I made a resolution until like March.
Right.
So, yeah.
But so still, this can't be that
delayed. But in time for Chinese
frankly,
New Year.
You told me before, I think it was... pretty close to the new year, what your resolution was going to be. So I found that a big development.
I'm on the ball this year. I actually have two resolutions that are sort of linked.
Okay.
Just in case one is a complete failure that I can go with. And not that I want to succeed, but I think the big difference between you and I, as we're shortly going to discover, is I do my resolutions with the show in mind. You do your resolutions with you and I in mind, which are two slightly different things. And that's not a criticism. I think that's
no,
just
no.
Sort
I'm
of
trying to think of what it means, really. You know, okay. I don't feel criticized.
All right. Well, no. Anyway, don't.
But before we get to that, you know, the fact that we're here means that we didn't win the Powerball.
No, we didn't. Did you play the Powerball?
Oh, yeah. No, I played. When it gets to a certain level, the mathematics. I was trying to explain it to somebody, but it's the expected value, because as the dollars accrue, even though it's a horrible bet, it actually becomes better than your wager amount. You know, like the odds are such that it's basically like, you know, if something was a 1 in 3 chance of winning,
okay,
it's worth 1/3 of the price, because if you could do it 3 times, you'd break even, kind of thing.
I've never looked at it that way.
Yeah, they call it the expected value of anything. It's like, it's basically a fraction based on your odds, based on the potential win. And at some point, because the Powerball accumulates money, it can actually become better, like your odds may be so tiny, but what you're paying relative to what you get out actually kind of makes some sense.
Okay, right. I see what you're saying.
But at the low levels, it does. I mean, otherwise, it's a complete soak. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I was actually reading something talking about the percentages of dollars wagered that actually come back in the form of winnings, and it's infinitesimal. It's like probably 10 or 20% after, like, the fees go out to people, the parts go off to the governments, the parts go off to the payment for this process, the parts go off to the taxes. It's a really very small amount of money that actually comes back out of the pool.
You mean come out of the pool to the winner?
Yeah, like meaning like the number of dollars that are bet versus the number of dollars that come back out in winnings.
Okay,
it's a horrible percentage. Like, you know, like blackjack is more or less, let's call it a 50-50 proposition.
It's like 51 and a half, isn't it, or something?
But, you know, basically the amount of money coming in is not that far off from the amount of money that comes back out, because
it's just
a 50-50 thing. But it's just the worst thing ever.
Do you play the lottery regularly?
No.
See, I do. I got into this habit, I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, when I play Mega Millions, which is the other one.
Mm-hmm.
There's Mega Millions and Powerball.
Yeah.
I play about a couple of years ago. Mega Millions had got itself in this situation where it was one of those, the jackpot is huge, and everyone was buying tickets. Mm-hmm. And I bought, and I've always gambled in my life on things, on sports, on mm-hmm. I go to the horse races quite a lot. I enjoy a flutter, I think is the expression. Once I started playing Mega Millions, I suddenly, because I play the same numbers every time.
Is that right?
Yes. And I now have this sort of weird, and this is the scam of it all, I have this weird obsession.
If I don't
play,
and those numbers come up,
that'll be the week when that 900 billion to one shot comes in. So now I play Mega Millions twice a week. $10 a week into Mega Millions.
Do you do it as a subscription? Because I think some places you can subscribe to those numbers and you automatically get the order delivered to you each week.
No, I just have the same card, and then I have the numbers on my phone. So if my little form doesn't run, I can get another form and fill it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually play lottery now out of fear. Fear that if I don't play...
Oh, I totally see that. I mean, like, if you play those numbers, now are those numbers, are they of personal significance, or are they just numbers?
They're just numbers.
Okay.
They're just numbers.
But that's one of the things they say. One of the things they say is people do personal numbers. And one of the things you have to be aware of when you start betting more, when the pool gets big enough, is the fact that multiple people can win.
Yeah.
And so people tend to do birthdays and things like that. Well, that means all your numbers, you've cut off half of the range of potential numbers, because the balls go up to 60-something now. I forget what it is. We'll talk about that again in a second. But if all you're doing is dates, the highest you're going to get is up to 30 and 12s, and, you know, depending upon
which part of the calendar it is that you're
putting in the date. And so
I'm not some
deranged
gambler just gambling without any kind of sense or logic. Are you kidding?
Right. But one of the reason people probably know this by this point, but the pool has gotten so big because they expanded the number of numbers, so they reduced the odds of winning just in December, I think, of last year. So it used to be 1 in 100 and something million, and now it's 1 in 292 million, the result being fewer time. There's more occasions when nobody will win.
Yes.
Therefore, the pool will accumulate, and look, they're being proven correct. Now, it'd be interesting to see if, you know, if that's a limited duration effect, that people are excited about $1.5 billion, the next time it goes to $1.5 billion, it's clearly not going to have that buzz, you know, and after a while, people expect something more.
As I've just said, I got into the habit of playing the lottery from about 3 or 4 years ago when it was one of those mega jackpots that was on the news. Right. And this one definitely did seem bigger than any.
You got a high.
Let me tell you something interesting, too. Back in England around the same time, back in Britain, the British lottery reached record levels. And I just thought it was interesting that in two of our podcast
markets. Yeah, but wasn't there a record level like in the hundreds?
It wasn't like Powerball here. That was gazillions or whatever it is.
There was actually, there was a podcast, not to advertise other podcasts, but the NPR has Planet Money. It's a 50-minute podcast, and they had a thing all about the history of the lottery, which they apparently the original one is British, but it was a very... you should go check it out. It's a nice 15-minute podcast after you're done with ours. You can go check it out. Explained, you know, the first version of it, how it worked. It wasn't really numbers, and the fact that it was a complete bust the first time around. Nobody did it again for 100 years, and then they came back to it. And then also there's a whole discussion of a person who basically cornered the market, like in Virginia, in fact. They bought all of the tickets for a lottery when it became timely. They bought all the potential numbers, made a ton of money. They've now since outlawed that practice.
Yeah.
And he now lives on a tropical island he owns somewhere.
He's done very well for himself. Mm-hmm. Did you play this time around?
I did, yeah. I mean, I can't remember if I threw a $10 or $20 down and just said, you know, give me whatever number.
Because I ended up in a pool at my place of work where someone had sort of corralled various employees. We all ended up throwing in a couple of dollars. I can't remember how many lines we ended up with, but it was 52 people. And I'd seen the list of people. Some people had paid $2, some people had paid $5.
Oh, really? It's variable.
Yeah, and I didn't quite know how that worked. But then an email came out saying that if we win, it's being split 52 ways.
Oh boy, it's a good thing you didn't, because that's instant litigation.
Yeah. Well, we didn't. I think we won. Apparently, I heard a story that we'd won $14. And at that moment, what did I care about that being split 52 ways? But I'm sure there's someone who's going, yeah, I want my 35 cents. That's
whoever
to
put
me.
In the $5 can get the first dibs on the money there.
So that was one of the first times I'd actually.
I think only one of, like, so we had three winners in this one. And I think only one of them has come forward. I think they're still looking for the other two. And the one that came forward, it's a couple, and they're like, oh, we're going to work on Monday. And I'm sure lots of people think this is what's going to happen, and they do it for a couple of weeks. But there's no chance when you have – I think if you took the lump sum, you end up with $300-something million out of this as one of the three winners out of the $1.5 billion.
I've always said – I'm always one of those people who have said, and as an active lottery player, when I say this, this means something. Mm-hmm. Unlike you, who doesn't play the lottery – you can't speak with any sort of gravitas as to what you would do if you won the lottery. Right. But as someone who plays twice a week, I used to be one of those people who would say, I'm just going back to work and I'm just going to know that I can live comfortably. Mm-hmm. But actually, knowing that that's not going to happen, the minute I win the lottery, I'm going to have a flame out day of purchasing and resigning spectacularly and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna cling to this. Well, I just go to work and live a normal life. No way, man. I'm going straight down to the Range Rover dealership, buying a Range Rover, and then getting fired from work and celebrating.
Would you
with
not
a
like try
steak.
To yeah, just for the yeah. sake of your coworkers? Would you not try to gently transition whatever you're doing over to them, or not put them in a spot where they got to figure out what the heck you were doing before you won $300 million?
I mean, to be honest with you, no. Because I'd be a gazillionaire. It's not my problem. The whole point of winning the lottery is to transport you away from that life.
Yeah.
So I would not attempt to cling on to that. Like, because at the end of the day, what's the point of being a millionaire and still sitting there?
Well,
at work?
That, I mean, like, listen,
do you know what I mean?
My point was ultimately these people are not going to continue to work. They can pretend they're going to work for a couple of weeks, but when they're thinking about what's in their bank account, they're going to be like, I don't really feel like getting up this morning and going to that friggin' meeting. You know?
If you're busy going on your first shopping spree, You just don't have time to go to work. So, I mean, really. Yeah.
One of the other funny things about it is I went to the Powerball website when I was trying to figure out numbers and statistics and things.
Yeah, you sent me this stuff. It was really funny.
So there's, I guess it's not unknown because, in fact, it seems like a bunch of the people are playing with this. But they have a frequently asked questions section and then and letters to the – both and then a bunch of email responses. But they're all done – not all, I should say. You know, there's a lot of real ones. But a bunch of them are done with humor.
I think they're all real.
Yeah, oh, no, they're real things. Yes. But I mean, the response is like in the frequently asked questions isn't even particularly answered. The ones I'm reading – I have a couple here I'll read off in the email –
now, again, this is in the frequently asked questions section. So if you go to any website, you're expecting frequently asked questions to involve all the mundane things.
Yeah, and it had some of that.
Where can I cash in my numbers?
What time are these things released? What are the statistics associated with
them? How long is my ticket good for? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Like so, but here were some sample emails from Deborah W. I don't remember my Powerball numbers. My name is Deborah W. And they blank out the rest. And the answer is, the number is on your Powerball ticket. The ticket is under the seat of your car, between the seat and the car door. Another one says, you know, from MR, on the FAQ page, it says that an annuity is guaranteed. In this economy, how is it guaranteed? And the answer is, the word guarantee is certainly overused from time to time, but if it can have any meaning in the English language, then it can be used with the Powerball jackpot. You can imagine some instances where even a Powerball jackpot will not continue. One, a meteor strikes North America, wiping out all life. Or two, the U.S. government is overrun by, quote, brackets, insert name of feared enemy. Short of these events, the Powerball annuity prize will be paid on schedule. And then they go on to like how they do the payments and what the amounts are. But
so it's a very funny mix of real information. Which is sort of surprising
because you got to guess when it comes to the Powerball that there's a certain – there's got to be a lot of – it's a governmental – although it's run by a private enterprise that's, you know, contracted with the government. Yeah. But there's got to be a certain amount of tightness, lawyering, you know, people making sure that people don't promise things. On the other hand, maybe because – it's just the numbers. Like, there's not a lot of nuance in things. People either have the numbers or they don't. And so your lawyers must maybe are like, say whatever you want to say. It doesn't really matter. People don't win unless they get the numbers. They can't come in claiming, like, damages.
Well, I'm going to say something now about the lottery experience. And now I'm someone who has now played the lottery for 3 years twice a week. Now, and then I'm now going to talk briefly about my own attitude to gambling. I don't have any problem gambling on sports or gambling on horse races because I feel at some moment I have an innate skill that's going to aid me win. I'm going to pick the Redskins because I know that they have a better quarterback than the Raiders. The lottery is no skill.
Right.
And I think deep down inside...
You can't betray yourself by thinking too much.
Deep down inside, everyone who plays the lottery knows that I'm just taking a complete flyer. Right. And I also think that deep down inside, everyone who plays the lottery knows my chances of winning meaningful money are a gazillion to one.
Yeah. That's why, like, it's, when it comes to the big numbers, big dollars... spending $2, $10, whatever, it's half of the fun that causes you to think about it. I mean, that's good enough for me. But there are people who go nuts on this.
Sure, but what I'm saying is, to finish my point, therefore, the lottery website itself has kind of this irreverent attitude to everything. Because they kind of know that this is like, it's like just getting out there and betting on who's going to get struck by lightning first. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
There's no controversy. It's not like it's interesting because we're recording today and we're recording on a day when in the real sports world, there's all that news of the tennis matches being fixed.
Yeah, I haven't gotten to read up on it yet.
But I can understand if you're gambling on real tennis, then at some moment you're getting your litigious end up because someone somewhere might have ripped you off.
Right.
In the lottery... no.
Although, meanwhile, there was a Powerball scandal just recently.
That's true.
And nobody seems to be paying any attention to it. Not Powerball, one of the other lotteries where, like, there was some sort of fixing, like people buying the tickets who were in the know or something like that. But totally nuts. But nobody seems to care because it's known to be kind of a scam to begin with.
It's all good fun.
Yeah. Here you go. Well, that's enough about Powerball, right? We can get on to our resolutions.
Yeah, let's do it.
So for anybody who hasn't listened before, each year we come up with a couple of New Year's resolutions for each of ourselves individually. Yep. And then the following year, what we've done is said, you know, how successful we were, to the extent the resolutions have lent themselves to some sort of recap or discussion. Yep. That's we've used them. That's what we're going to do this time. And then we'll wrap up by coming up with our new New Year's resolutions.
That's right.
So last
and
year.
Can I say something before we embark on the resolution show? That this podcast has changed my life because I never really ever did resolutions and committed to them. And so since we've been doing this show together, we now make resolutions and I damn well stick them out just to prove a point.
Exactly. I was going to say, it isn't because Zeph actually believes in the resolution. It's because he believes in being able to say, aha, I did it.
Yeah.
Spite
of resolution.
I should note for everybody, my theory has always been, I think you're catching on to the theory, is when it comes to resolutions, you don't want to do resolutions that are purely about austerity and denying being cruel to yourself.
It's no
fun doing that.
There's no losing weight or any of this nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm not going to eat this type of food. What you want to do is have a resolution that enables you to do something that you would enjoy.
Yes.
But you're not diligent enough to make sure you do it on a regular basis anyway. I think the first year of my resolution was to eat more fajitas.
Yeah, and that thing died after about 6 weeks.
But I did eat more fajitas and I tried to sample in different locations. The end result was I still liked the fajitas I liked the best at the beginning of the year. I still liked at the end of the year best. So it wasn't great revelation. The next year it was to drink more whiskey. And by that, I mean taste a bunch of whiskeys. Yep. That was a booming success. Tried like a whole bunch of different types. And then we had our recap show and had way too much whiskey during the podcast. Last year, my resolution was to brew beer. And so we'll talk about how that went in a second. And what were your first couple? One year you didn't really do
it. I didn't do it because I took the position that why am I doing
it? It was probably my fajita year.
It was your fajita year. But then last year you were recommending music.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, so that was good for recapping.
And so that was good for recapping. And it was good. It was interesting. I was back going in through my iTunes, as I'm an Apple person, a couple of weeks ago, and I was tidying it up. And I suddenly found all these albums that I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, this was one I did for the show. And to your point, it's an enjoyable – even though some of the albums I wouldn't listen to again, listening to new-to-me music – was a good experience.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like personally, like you'd like to, ideally you pick something that's perfect, personally beneficial in that it's enjoyable, but it also makes, add something to your brain or some sort of knowledge. It's not like I'm just going to eat a lot of cake, you know?
Yeah.
They want to have something that just says, that I'm going to indulge myself. Well, that's not exactly what I mean. So anyway, so mine was the brew more beer. Yours was?
Get back to reading books because I'd gone many years without reading books.
Right.
And I actually ended up, as we'll talk about shortly, I think I've read 6 or 7 this year, which I know if you are already a voracious reader, you are raising an eyebrow going, seriously, I read 3 books a month.
All right.
But for me, that was a big deal because I used to be a reader and then I went for a decade where I didn't read, just reading websites and magazines. And, it was interesting, before we get into some of these books, which I know we will, I actually felt like I accomplished something last year.
Yeah?
Yeah, I did. I went back to reading, and I'm like, yeah, now I'm in the habit of reading again.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds really throwaway, because you and I are both vaguely intelligent people. You know what I mean? We are relatively well-read men, but I had completely lost the habit of reading books, and now I read books again.
Well, let's start. So because as we'll come out of the course of the podcast, you have more volume to offer in the sense of this. I'm going to open a beer, which is the first beer I brewed this year, which I've kept cold and hopefully hasn't gone bad in the interim because it was quite a while ago that I brewed it. But in the meantime, we're going to start talking about maybe one of your books.
I'll talk about one. Of the books that we're not going
to
play.
And then we'll come back to me and my beer stuff.
But okay. One of the books I read was
beer opening.
And I have a short story. When I was back in the mid-70s, I stole a book from my school library, and it was called Goshawk Squadron. And it was a war book written by a guy called Derek Robinson, and it was about a World War I fighter squadron. Sort of flying Sopwith camels and going against the Red Baron and this type of thing. It was a very quick book. It was about 150 pages. It was written in like 1973. I remember reading it as a young man and I was blown away. It's not a heroic book at all. It's sort of like a literary version of the movie MASH, which I know we talked about the other week. It's sort of a black comedy. It talks about the fact that, war is hell and you just got to grin and bear it. And it was also a book that really skewered, sort of those old British attitudes about snobbery and stiff upper lip and sportsmanship and all this sort of thing. And the whole point with the book was, no, war isn't heroic. It's people dying horrible deaths. Anyway, so this chap, Derek Robinson, has written a whole load of books about the RAF. One was called A Piece of Cake, which if you watch PBS, it was serialized on PBS. It was about a Spitfire squadron at the start of the Battle of Britain. another one called A Good Clean Fight. They're all very similar. They're all, you know, they're very funny in a very dark way. You know, it's not some sort of 50s war heroic literature. You think of all the anti-war movies you've read. That's what these are. They're all very funny. They all have great characters. Anyway, I found a book called Hornet Sting on my shelf, written by the same chap, and it features the same characters that were in this book that I read all these years ago. In the book stay with me now as I explain this.
Yeah,
the
book I read. We talked a lot about a book that you haven't read, but
no, but
I'm reading the one you have read.
In the book I read all those years ago called Goshawk Squadron, the lead character dies at the end. He spends the whole book teaching other people how to kill and how you've got to be alert up there and this isn't like on the cricket field. And then at the end of the book, and this is a spoiler for a 40-year-old book, he's thinking about his new girlfriend and he's not concentrating and a German pilot kills him. But he's a hilarious character. He drinks Guinness the whole time. He's very working class. He's really abusing these upper class officer types who think it's going to be a jolly old thing being mm-hmm. in the Air Force. He's a great character, but unfortunately, this author killed off the character right. 40 years ago. So this author then, with more books, did more stories about the Air Force, and all his books are sort of written in small groups of three and four, and certain characters and certain people. There's no one central character,
right.
But characters.
It's not one overall world, yeah. But a little couple of individual ones, and then yeah. He plays with them in different scenarios.
So basically, this guy wrote this book in the 90s called Hornet Sting, which is a prequel introducing the character from a book from even further ago that you really like. So it's an interesting way. It's almost like that modern sort of thing in the movies now where you reboot.
Sure.
I read the book because I love the character, but here's the story about this book. I'm reading this book, and I have these books in front of me, and it's about 350 pages, and it's a paperback. Now, I'm one of those people that when I read, I dog-ear the pages. I don't waste time with a bookmark, because my hang-up is, if I'm carrying the bookmark will fall out, and then I don't know where I am. Mm-hmm. So I've always dog-eared the pages. So I'm reading this book, Hornet's Thing, thinking, ooh, I've owned this book for years, and I've never read it. I need to read it. And about 120 pages, 120 pages in, there are moments in the book that are kind of familiar. But I'm suddenly thinking, well, they're only familiar because these characters appear in another book. So right. I keep plowing on. But 180 pages in, I suddenly realize that, oh, this page looks like it's been folded over before.
Uh-huh.
And so all of a sudden I realized I had read this book, but about 15 years ago. So that's my story about that book. But if you ever get a chance, if you ever like stories about war,
Hornet Sting, Derek Robinson is the author. More broadly, I assume you're going to put a bunch of these on there. I mean, there's no reason not to count these things.
But I want to just read to give you a sense of what I mean. And I'm not going to sit here and read, but I'm going to read like two sentences from this book. And so this is Derek Robinson. There was no dawn. The night merely gave up and left. And gray daylight took its place with no enthusiasm. So it's this sort of throwaway, you know, war is crazy. But, you know, like, do you know what I mean? It's not some 18th century charge of the light.
No. It sounds like what we were talking about MASH last week, right? So it's a precursor. It's like sort of a catch 20, catch 22.
There you go.
It's not quite.
But it's that sort of thing.
But it's something with a dark comedy element.
If you have a dark sense of humor, then these are definitely books that might appeal to you. So that's Derek Robinson and this particular book, Hornet's Thing. He's now about 80 years of age, but he's written about 14 different books. Look him up on Amazon.com, and they are very funny. Either funny things happen or characters are unintentionally funny.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I really enjoy.
All right. So as you had started discussing that, I poured a bit of the first beer I made.
Yep.
It's a brown ale, which we actually tasted this somewhere along with mine in another podcast. And of course, people will know we did a podcast of me brewing beer, which a big fiasco audio-wise. That was like a near impossible thing to do to try to record in the kitchen.
It was fun, but
it was not what I would call one of our finer produced products.
No.
But
this brown ale is finely produced.
Yeah,
I remember saying I liked it at the time.
Yep.
I'm tasting. I love the color. It's got that sort of dark chocolatey brown color. I'm a big brown ale guy.
It's a bit over carbonated at this point, but you know, you let it sit a little couple of minutes and it comes back to normal. It's not particularly robust. I'm the brewing that I did do, I kind of backed off on the hops. Everything is over hopped now, so I didn't want to do that. And you're never going to be able to compare to a professionally done beer.
I remember when we first tasted this, I think it was back in March. Can I ask you a question? Is the bottle that you've just opened, is it from the same batch?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so that was...
So, but I just kept it refrigerated since then. So, I mean, at some point, if you just kept it in room temperature, it might actually turn. But that refrigerated, it's fine. I mean, it doesn't appear to be poisoning us so far.
All right. I'm going to put you on the spot now to see how much you've learned from your year of brewing beer.
Yeah.
Do you feel that if I said to you, oh, can you whip up another batch of that brown ale that I really like? Would you expect it to taste exactly the same? Or is brewing beer an inexact science where the next batch might, you know, in the same way that wine tastes different depending on the years and all that
kind of
stuff?
Well, so the beers that I did that were successful, we did one that did not turn out successfully. I'll explain more about that momentarily or shortly. They're kits in that they're like you bought a set of ingredients from somebody. So somebody said, okay, it's this amount. I mean, you do all the cooking, but it's as if you bought what's that? There's a place you can do this with food now where you get all the food delivered to you in a recipe.
Oh, really?
And you put it all together. Blue Apron. I think it's a service.
It gets all delivered to you. I didn't know that, but yeah.
But the idea is you buy all these things and you have all these things in the kit and put it together. And so it should be the same. That said, the real difference, and this is, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself and talking about it. The big difference is that environmental factors, how you boil it, how all these things you do can result in different outcomes because, you know, there's enough different things you're going to do. And I think that's where ultimately, put it this way, you are going to probably continue reading books.
Yes.
I'm probably not going to continue brewing too much beer. I might do a bit on and off, but
because you've got all the key. You've got
your right. I don't want to stop, but it's
too much hassle.
Well, the thing is, you know, I first did this actually way back in like 1995, and that I did it some beer, maybe even before that. Now I think about it, yeah, 93 or so, and there weren't like a lot of beer options in the world. And so when you brewed your own beer, part of it was like, ooh, this will be beers that I can't necessarily get. Well, now you could get so much great stuff. Making it at home is a little peculiar. And it's not like you could analogize it to like cooking food, right? Like, so obviously you can go to a great restaurant, get a fantastic dish.
Okay.
Or you can make some stuff at home. So what, you know, in theory, why would you bother making it at home? Well, when you make it at home, you know, you get to eat it right away. It's right there. You know, you get to host your dinner party to have it or whatever you're going to do with your significant other. It's a much better deal financially. But when it comes to brewing your own beer, it's not, you don't quite get as much out of it. And you literally can have a batch just be horrible, right? Like, you know, most, you can make some bad food. It's usually still food you can eat. But the beer can be a mess. You're very focused on something with your video, and so I know you're actually not listening to what I'm saying.
I am listening. I am listening. I made that indicator to keep talking because I'm lining up the other technology. Uh-huh.
So anyway, you know, at the end of the day, the amount of effort that goes into it, and I was making small batches, and so it would be like 8 or 12 beers. That was the most beer I was going to make at a time. And to spend 5 hours to make 8 or 12 beers that are pretty good, but not nearly as good as, you know, the stuff you can buy at the grocery store. It's not that great.
Well, I got hung up. And to your point, I the one thing that really stood out in what you just said was just this whole notion nowadays that unlike maybe 25, 30 years ago, where you were so limited as to what one could buy, there was an attraction to home to create what you couldn't get. But You're right. In general, the beer market now, it doesn't matter where you live. You can go to your store, your local store, your sort of boutique delicatessen, and you can find microbreweries and big breweries doing new flavors. That you're right. In a strange way, I'm not suggesting that the need to homebrew has changed, but I'm sure the market is now smaller because people who used to homebrew because they wanted something different, well, they can now go and buy something different.
Yeah.
So they don't, so I mean, you know what I mean?
It's probably bigger in the sense that there's more people who turned on to different types of beers, but it is interesting to think is, you know, there's a lot, particularly in an area where you've got so many options and in an urban area where you got all these kind of beer places that are special, beer and wine places that specialize in 18 different things. And, or have a wide range of different things, you know, how fired up you're going to get to do it. So I probably will do it from time to time, but it's not going to become a once a month type of event.
All right. So that was our first beer, the brown ale. Again, very nice, though.
Yeah, worked out.
I mean, again, if you, you know, if you said to me, oh, you know, I was just mucking around that I made 2 6-packs, do you want 3 bottles? I would go, yes. And I'm like, how much would you want for it? That's how much, right. I liked it. I like a brown ale. So there you go. All right. So we're ready to talk about another book.
Yeah.
I'm going to play something. Whoops. I am.
Tyler gave the rules that he and I decided.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club. The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. Third rule of Fight Club, someone yells stop, goes limp, taps out, the fight is over. Fourth rule, only 2 guys to a fight. Fifth rule, 1 fight at a time, fellas. Sixth rule, no shirts, no shoes. Seventh rule, fights will go on as long as they have to. And the eighth and final rule, if this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight.
All right, that's Brad Pitt in the film.
Now that we just said the rules are we're not going to talk about Fight Club, we're going to talk about Fight Club.
We're going to talk about Fight Club, yeah. I decided to read the book Fight Club.
That, of course, is the movie, not the book.
The movie with Edward Norton and Brad Pitt, directed by David Fincher. Great movie. I remember trying to read the book when the movie came out, and the book was written about a year before the movie.
I was just checking in the inside covers. It's 96 is the copyright on the book.
And the movie, I think, is 98.
And the thing says cover art 1999, yeah. So that would make sense, because the cover art is one of the – this is always a big thing, slight divergence. You know, whenever a book comes out as a movie,
yes,
we always try in this household to find the copies of the book that don't have the movie covers.
I'm with you, yeah.
You know, but a lot of times you have to like run right out there if you realize, oh my goodness, I always wanted to read that book. It's coming out as a movie. I better run out there and get the book before they all switch over to the movie-based covers, and this one has the movie cover.
Well, Fight Club is written by a chap called Chuck Palahniuk, I think. I don't know how to pronounce it.
Maybe you should spell it for everybody.
Palahniuk. Palahniuk. I'm going to call him Chuck Palahniuk.
I don't know if that's really spelling, but okay.
He wrote it in 96. Apparently, in Wikipediaing the film Fight Club and the book, it was one of those books that came out, and it was immediately studios were falling over themselves to option the script because it was very modern, very cutting edge. So the reason I also just played that clip from Fight Club is, A, that's a really famous clip. You know, these are the rules of Fight Club. But to also demonstrate why this is one of those books that is a terrific adaptation. Sorry, the film is a terrific adaptation of the book. That whole scene is lifted word for word from the book. So if you ever, if your only exposure to this story, Fight Club, is through the Brad Pitt, Edward Norton film, you're getting, if you watch the film, you're getting a
semi-faithful rendition.
No, I think you're getting more than semi. You're getting a very faithful rendition of the book. Here's the interesting thing, and I know this was, and again, I specifically picked this book because I'd started to read it years ago and I hadn't finished it, but also because it was a film.
Did you find dog ears in that one?
No, I did not. No. if you've seen Fight Club, it's all kind of surreal. Not just the story, and we're going to get to the big twist in a moment, but just the way it's filmed, and there's voiceovers, and there's quick cutting, and it's very snap.
Oh, I remember when it first came out, like, because they have a bunch of parts that were, they had like little captions on the screen and things like, it was kind of a big deal at the time.
It's very different from the standard film where it just tells the story. It does justice to the book, because the book is like that. And what I mean by that is the book is written in the first person. It's I, but then there are moments when it's you're doing this and you're doing that. So it suddenly veers into the second person. The book has short sentences and long sentences and thoughts as sentences. And there's not a lot of dialogue. It's just he said this, she said that type thing. And in a strange way, if you've seen the film first and you read the book, you sit there and go, wow, the film does a really good job of recreating this sort of manicness. You know, stylistically, the book is a very good, not reflection, but representation of a book that is not the standard paragraph one, paragraph two, chapter two, chapter. It's all over the place. Here was the interesting thing in reading Fight Club for me. Obviously, and now massive, if you've not seen Fight Club, then, you know, sorry, spoilers.
Right, yeah.
The whole point of Fight Club is the lead character at the end, you discover, is basically schizophrenic.
Yep.
Or he has an... I don't know if that's exactly the correct term.
Probably right, because yeah, he's got a split personality.
He has a split personality brought about by the fact that he just doesn't sleep enough.
If you hear a noise here, it's just me opening the other beer while you talk.
In the film, they're able to get away with it by casting two different actors. Now, here's what I mean. Have you ever seen a TV show where you have, I'm thinking of some old 70s spy or cop show where the lead character's evil twin suddenly appears and he's playing both parts. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Fight Club didn't do that. It had two different actors basically play two halves of one guy's personality. But what I'm saying is the film, you watch the film, and when the ending comes and the big reveal comes that Brad Pitt is in fact Edward Norton,
right,
you are completely blown away.
Right, because you've been watching two people the whole time.
It's interesting. The book can't do that.
No, it can't be like, this guy looks different than the other guy. It's supposed to be.
And yet the book does this great job.
Does it do, like most books would say, oh, you know, so-and-so was this. He was, you know, like, oh, he was 6 foot whatever. And he was, I guess they probably don't do that in introducing the character.
No, the characters talked about, there are two characters. There's you, there's I, the writer, the narrator, and then there's Tyler Durden.
Right.
And I am always referring to Tyler Durden, but things start getting confused when... Like I say, it's written in the first person, but when all of a sudden it's you do this and you do that, when you go back and continually reread it, it's all really well put together. And you can suddenly see the book gets away with selling an idea that ultimately the film actually doesn't have any problem getting to.
Right.
You just cast different people. And it's interesting. I'm trying to find the page. Oh, I've lost it. I wrote it down. The big reveal in the book when he realizes that Tyler Durden is him is still done unbelievably well.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the interesting thing about a film and a book experience like this. Once you've seen the film, whatever order you do it in immediately taints how you enjoy the story Fight Club. What I'm saying is this. Having seen the film Fight Club.
Right. When you read it, you already know what's happening.
You already know what's happening. And so you can never truly judge the book on does it pull it off as a book. I would imagine if you'd read it the other way around, I would imagine the film would actually explain a lot of things to you that you didn't quite get when you read it. Because it is quite a tough read because it's trying to, you know.
What you need to do is read the book and then forget you read the book. Like some people, this happens to them, and then you would be able to see it fresh.
No, don't you read the book and forget you've seen the film? Isn't that what you're trying to do?
The other book you mentioned, you read it, but you forgot you read it. So if you read the book and you forgot you read the book, then when you went to see the movie, you wouldn't be knowing the surprise that was going to come.
It is interesting. Fight Club is one of those films that's sort of become cult. They say it's become cult. It didn't do that well when it first came out. But it is a film that... I see it on cable a lot, and I always end up either watching
it's
it
or watching it. I was about to say, I mean, one of the things I thought of, it is very easy to jump into,
even
though you know what's going to come, because all the steps are sort of interesting.
Yes. It's one of those things you keep peeling back layers, and it's one of those things that it lends itself to rewatching. I'm not sure I would read the book again, because it is quite hard work, because you're basically...
Kind of a skinny book.
But you're trying to step into the mind of someone who's clearly out there a little bit. Right. But... Knowing the film, again, and I keep getting it wrong how I say it, the film does a great job of reflecting its source material.
Good. So you recommend the book still? Obviously, a bunch of people, you know, they've had the movie spoiled for them and the book spoiled for them now if they haven't seen it before. But would, like somebody who had seen the movie before already knows what happens, is it worth reading the book?
Yeah, I would read it, yeah. As an experience, it's quite an...
Well, I think just the lesson of how the two do it differently.
Yeah,
or how they do it the same.
And I think here's the thing about it. When I read the book, I didn't so much read it for pleasure. I read it as an exercise, and I was reading the book to see how does it match up to the film. Not in a very sort of base level, but what I mean is how does it pull off the things that the film has shown me by just having two different actors. Mm-hmm. And in a strange way, I appreciate the book as a written piece of fiction because of that. It's quite hard work as a book because it's, again, they're crazy and it's anarchy and it's all kinds of stuff. It's probably easier if you just want entertainment, watch the film. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that to put a boot into the book, but if you are interested in how literature is written, read the book. It's definitely worth it.
All right. So meantime, I opened a American Pale Ale. It was the second beer I made. It was another one that was a kid from a local homebrew shop. In fact, the place I think we talked about before called My Local Homebrew yep. Shop. This is impressive. It's quite clear, which I don't remember it being that clear when I first made it.
But yeah, it looks like real beer.
It looks like regular beer. And it tastes like a pale ale. You know, it's more hoppy than the last one, but it's not overwhelmingly hoppy.
It's got a nice distinctive aroma.
Again, doesn't appear to be poisoning us, but
distinctive taste.
Yeah,
I don't know. This must be driving you berserk when I say things like this. Tastes like the real thing.
Yeah, yeah, right.
But it does, though. Do you know what I mean? And let me expand upon that before I let you talk about what you created here. I think there's a tendency sometimes with home stuff, homebrewed this or homemade that. The minute you say that, you're sort of subliminally letting whoever you're feeding or, you know, you're letting them know this is the home version.
Right.
But in a strange way, if you put this in front of me and didn't tell me where it came from, I wouldn't sit here and go, well, that's home brewed. And so in a strange way, that is a compliment to your ability on a small scale to match what gets done on a big scale.
Now, nowadays, compared to the beers you would have, somebody would say, well, it's kind of, it may be from a professional place, but it might be kind of boring. You know, But that's because nowadays everything hits you over the head with like some crazy amount of hops that you can like smell. It smells like pine trees or whatever it'll be.
It's got a great color.
Yeah.
And you said it yourself, it's clear. Mm-hmm. There's no sediment or anything, which I know is always one of those things that home brewers sort of not fight against, but they have to be aware of. And, you know, it's on top with, you know, as the head is dissipated. Again, I mean, it looks...
Yeah, it had more of a like a big bubble type of soda-ish head to start, but it's... Again, it settled down pretty nicely.
If you served me that, I go, oh, yeah, it's good, that.
There you go.
I don't know if I'd buy it again because I'm not as much an IPA fan. But again, the same things I said about the brown ale, I say about that. I mean, it's very, yeah.
Yeah. So the third batch that was actually made as part of the resolution was the one we did the recordings for. Now, that one, I got a recipe online, and it was what you call an all-grain recipe. Like, these kits typically have stuff where somebody's extracted from the malt, like the right sugars and things like that. So you don't have to do – reduces the steps you have to do. And this one that we're having was like a mix of cracked grains and extract and things. The one that I made next was all extract, and it was like it was like boiling a big thing of porridge or oatmeal.
Yeah.
And it had a great smell and all this, but it was a lot more work. And that one, I put it up and to ferment, and it was doing well, and it just sort of stopped along the ways. And I don't know why. I consulted with my brother, who's an expert, which we're gonna have one of his beers shortly here as a contrast.
Okay.
And we didn't really know, you know, it could have been something in the way it was boiled and it didn't have the right enzymes or killed off some enzyme, or the yeast didn't take the right way because you put in this package of yeast and who knows, it didn't get along. But by the time you figured out it wasn't going well, you're done, right? Like, you could kind of, once it was, because you put it in there to ferment, it's bubbling, it's you know, it's going through its process, and then it stops. You can kind of take a second stab at it, but once you don't get it fermenting properly, now it's going to spoil. Like, that's the whole thing. Like, you ferment the beer, it's developing the alcohol and things that prevent it from growing bad stuff. Well, now, you know, you leave it out at room temperature for a week while it's not doing anything. Now it's going to start growing weird stuff, you know. It's not going to taste like anything good. So I ended up having to dump it out.
But that's what happens, isn't it? It's not like something where you can stick it back on the stove again.
Right.
It doesn't.
And I remember, actually, the first time I did this was the thing. The first time I did some brewing, this was the thing that frustrated me, because I was making big 5-gallon batches, is you would go through all this process, and for whatever reason, something wouldn't work out. Maybe something wasn't as clean as it should be, or something like didn't come out well. And you go, I just spent all day putting this thing together, and it's nothing. And like I said, like, if you mess up food, you know, you're cooking something on the grill and you overcook it, or you do something, or you don't spice it the right way, it's still food, you know. Yeah. Like, it's not like you don't, and you know what happens right then, you know, like, you know, you're about to have dinner, we're like, better order pizza. Instead, you do all this stuff, you put it together, you spend a bunch of time, it sits in a thing, and you realize halfway through, like, oh, that was for nothing.
I have
nothing
well,
out of it, and I find that very frustrating.
It's funny, you can rescue, there are all these cooking techniques for rescuing things.
I guess baked items are kind of more similar to
that. Like, this is like baking.
You bake something, it fails, you know, and you can't eat bread that doesn't bake properly.
But what's that old thing, if you've made like a soup or a stew or a chili and it's too salty,
right?
If you lash a raw potato in,
is that right? Okay.
Apparently the potato draws out some of the salt.
Makes sense.
And while it doesn't taste as you might have intended it, where you've got, oh, it's too salty, well, you don't have to get rid of it. Yeah. Throw in a few potatoes, you rescue it a little bit, you still serve it up. People don't know the difference. But unlike brew and beer, it's dead and gone.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? How did you feel? I want an emotional reaction when you were like, oh, this isn't coming out.
Well, it's annoyed. It's disappointing. Yeah. I briefly thought about doing the same recipe again so that when we got to the New Year's resolution episode, I wouldn't have to paper over the fact that we brewed that one on the air.
Yeah, that's right.
And did not actually taste it.
That's the one that failed. Yeah.
Like, so now, but I, you know, again, I just didn't have time. And that's it. I mean, it's definitely like, you got to do it on a weekend. First of all, I work late enough that I can't come back at like 8 o'clock at night and like brew a batch of beer.
We were here a good. I remember when we did that show. The show was only an hour, but it was a good 3.5 hours.
So you
got
to find some weekend day to like spend your time doing that and making a mess and doing all that. Now, meanwhile, I got some friend of mine who's actually making his own whiskey. You know, we talked about
whiskey.
And I thought for sure when he tells me this, I'm like, oh, you must buy some whiskey and you buy some wood to age it. And, you know, you buy basically the white whiskey that doesn't have any flavor. And it's like, no, we're starting from scratch. And I'm like, well, first of all, I'm not even sure that's legal, because it's one thing to brew beer, but in order to distill, you gotta like boil a bunch of flammable products in your house. But I think he's doing it, he and a group are going together, and maybe there's a facility you can do it in. They're making a barrel of whiskey. But here's the other funny thing about it, right? Just like the beer being a big commitment, you know, the whiskey, if it goes badly, you brewed a barrel of it, you know, like just a tremendous amount of whiskey, or you made you distilled a barrel of whiskey. Plus, you're like totally committed to that whiskey, even if it goes well. You know, so, like I can't get through that much whiskey, like to have gallons and gallons of whiskey around. You got to start giving it away, I assume, if you're successful.
But what I'm saying is you can't save whiskey either. Any of these things
if it went bad, it would, I imagine it would be turpentine or something like that.
Yeah, any of these things where you're sort of, you know, fermenting and whatever, then, you know, it's dead and gone, right?
Yep.
All right, so we ready to do another book?
Yeah. One more book, you think?
No, we'll do two more, because I'll go through this quickly.
The future.
We're going to do this quickly.
Shut up. And don't eat it all at once.
He loves me.
Instinctively.
You know, Zeph picked books that have movie correlations. Yeah.
Intensely.
All right, so you are currently listening to the end of the movie On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I'm a big Bond fan. I had to read a James Bond book.
Mm-hmm.
I always read a James Bond book. This is right at the end of the movie now, where the villains come by and kill James Bond's wife. So, spoiler for those of you who haven't seen it.
I can't see it. Who's
George? This is George Lazenby.
Okay, this is, yeah.
So the villains have just shot and killed James Bond's wife.
How, and I'm going to let him... They're married like a couple hours or something?
Yeah, basically, yeah. So this is right at the end of the film, because I'm going to give a shout out to this particular film by talking about the book.
It's all right. It's quite all right, really. She's having a rest. Going on soon. There's no hurry, you see. We have all the time in the world.
We have all the time in the world.
Very emotional. Zeph's crying right now.
Ending lifted straight from the novel. Everything that's said, everything that happens, straight in the novel. James Bond, a big James Bond fan, obviously. And so I know because we Over the Horizon, we have a Star Wars show. So I'm going to give a shout out to my franchise. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, again, it's the James Bond book where he gets married. And then at the end, his wife is killed very tragically. And then in the book series, he goes halfway mental and is sent to Japan just because the boss is like, you're out there. So he sends him on some impossible mission in order to see if he gets his mind back. Obviously, 80% of the James Bond films take only aspects of each book, a character name, mm-hmm. a moment, and then do that completely their own thing. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the film is unbelievably true to On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the book. So if you've never seen the film or read the book, I would suggest you do both. One of the reasons people haven't seen the film is because it's the James Bond film that was done by George Lazenby, who did it just one time when Sean Connery first stepped away. And as a film, it's been lost for 30 years because people go, well, it's the other guy, and they don't pay any attention.
Right.
All of a sudden, people now rediscover the film and they go, wow, this is brilliant, even though the guy playing James Bond isn't Sean Connery. It's a great film. The book is terrific. And large, just like Fight Club that we talked about, large sections of the film's script are lifted straight from the book. And again, I think there's a tendency with James Bond to sort of, you know, it's all a bit throwaway and, well, you know, it's like Pulp Fiction. And while Ian Fleming, yeah, he is a couple of steps above Pulp Fiction, it's not comic book. Back in the day, I mean, these were very popular books. They were the equivalent of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of, you know, guys in recent years who've written sort of the big major bestsellers. Well, think of who's the woman who wrote Gone Girl and Girl on the Train and all those sort of books? Well, back in the day in the 50s, James Bond was those books. It was immediately came out. It went to the top of the bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
JFK famously said that From Russia with Love was one of his favorite books. And that obviously helped spur interest in the books themselves. JFK was correct. From Russia with Love is a great book. It's actually a better book than this one, but mm-hmm. this one is really, really good. Fleming's a really, in rereading these books again, and being a fan of the films, it's, you know, the books tend to get forgotten. Ian Fleming was a really good, not a really good writer. I know it's a really trite statement, but he was a journalist. He had a big, he'd spent some time as a journalist, and so his books are written in that very readable journalism sort of style. He's got a great eye for places and for people. And so the descriptions are very vivid. Obviously, one of the criticisms of the books, because they were written in the 50s, they do contain a lot of 1950s attitudes.
Well, this one was from 63, am I reading?
Yeah, and it's like his second last, it's like his third last book. It was like the 12th one that he wrote.
Yeah, because it says he passed in 64.
Yeah, so it was one of the last ones that he wrote.
You have a copy here. It's got a sort of a retro-looking cover,
yeah.
But I assume this is not an actually old book.
No, it's
a
reprint.
They just threw the old
And what happens with the James Bond books, I think there are 14 original novels. They just republish them every 5 years. And there are people
they
that
didn't
just
want to put George Lazenby on the cover.
No, no. There's no movie.
Not buy that one.
There's no movie time with that one. So anyway, as a James Bond fan, I went back and I read a James Bond book. I like to read one or two every now and again. From Russia with Love is a great James Bond book. Dr. No is a great James Bond book. Thunderball is a great James Bond book. That's my opinion. I'm going to read the one after this, which is You Only Live Twice. The movie You Only Live Twice is set in Japan, and it's about space rockets and volcanoes. The book You Only Live Twice is set in Japan, but it's about James Bond being sent to Japan on an impossible mission to actually find his arch nemesis villain Blofeld, who is hiding in a castle surrounded by what's called a Garden of Death. And in Japan, they have all these, the urban legend has it that they had all these gardens where the young Japanese people would go to commit suicide. There are these gardens full of,
you know, there's a movie out.
There's a movie, yeah, exactly. And I was telling someone who was watching the movie going, do you think that's real? And I'm like, well, funnily enough, from reading the James Bond book, You Only Live Twice.
It is a real thing.
These suicide gardens.
There's a thing in the paper all about, like this woods that people go to.
Exactly.
I mean, it's a legendary story, yeah. But it's a real thing that people go to it.
So anyway, if you're ever in a mood for like a pulpy, and again, I hate using that word because that sounds really throwaway, but if you're ever in a mood for reading,
I was looking at the cover quote, you know, like they have things from, they must have taken stuff from the original reviews, obviously. And so from Newsweek, one of Bond's most ominous and chilling adventures. From Chicago Tribune, packed with danger, mystery, crime, and wild pursuit, to which the author has added sex in generous proportions.
Yeah, well, that's slightly hyping it up because the sex is.
Well, realize that's in 1963. That's the book review.
If the word breast appears in one sentence, that's the height of literary sex, 1962. Yep. But actually, they're a good read. So if you're ever in the mood for reading, like, you know, an old Raymond Chandler or one of those classics, why read one of these new off the shelf secret agent things? There are plenty of classic guys who've written stories about private eyes and secret agents and that type of thing, and they still hold up well today. I remember reading Ross McDonald books, who I think created the private detective Archer,
mm-hmm.
from back in the 50s and 60s. They're a great read. Raymond Chandler, The Long Goodbye. Those books are written 60 years ago, but they're still a great throwaway thriller read. So again, Ian Fleming is just the same. If you've never read an Ian Fleming book and you kind of like a James Bond movie, try one of these. I think you'll enjoy them.
All right. So in the meantime, I just cracked open a beer that's not mine.
Okay.
But because of the fact, I just wanted to talk about the whole difference of things. So, you know, I did basically we did three batches of beer, and so I put numbers on them to contrast. My brother is a much more avid home brewer, and this is number 26 for his, and I believe it's a black lager. I'm actually trying to text him as we're sitting here because I left a piece of paper upstairs that says what this is. Pretty sure it's a black lager. I know it has a touch of smoke and a maltiness to it, but let's try that out and see. Somebody who actually pays much closer attention to the mechanics of what they're brewing than I do.
What is a black lager? I see it advertised on TV. What is a black? I always think of lager as like a light yellow, urine sample colored.
It's like selling point.
You know, like a Budweiser, Stella, Heineken. I always think of those as lager. I have seen Guinness advertise black lager.
So I'm sure this repeats things we've talked about before, but the big split in beer, meaning the two versions, ales versus lagers, are really just about the fermentation temperature, types of yeast used. And so it's like two paths you can go by. You know, you mix up the malt, you do whatever it is that's got your sugars, and then you're either treating it as an ale, which means you're fermenting it more or less at room temperature, with a type of yeast where the yeast sits on top. A lager is fermented. Lager means to store because it's fermented with a different type of yeast at a colder temperature. It takes much longer. And so the Germans came up with the lager. Ales are traditionally a British thing, and of course a lot of other places. But which reminds me, I have a book. I have a book that ties this all together, all right. Which I can't remember the title of it. But the this one, a lager generally for home brewing takes more effort because now you have to get it to a cold temperature. And if you live somewhere in Florida, you're not going to be able to keep it cool enough without having a whole cooling system. But because he lives in the New England area, he can keep it in a basement and it stays the right temperature while he's fermenting it. And so I think – I'm pretty sure – and so this would be the what makes it black. So you think of lagers as being these light beers.
Yes.
Because they're more typically that. But it's not required, right? And so you can make it with the malts and things that might go into like a stout or an ale.
I mean, it's the same color as a stout,
right?
Or a porter.
I mean, it has some of those tastes, but a more of a crispier kind of approach to it.
It's very tasty, but I'm now going to have a. And because you didn't brew this, I'm now going to take I'm going to take a few shots, and you know.
Let me just point out before you do that,
okay,
that this might be our most faithful listener out there.
I know.
Has literally listened to every episode, supported us all along the way. So, you know, kind.
I'm going to preface it.
I think it's excellent.
I like
it. It's less carbonated than the ones we just had.
It's got a very clean, crisp taste. Here's my criticism. If you put that in front of me and don't tell me what it is, I'm going to think, ooh, it's a stout or a brown ale.
Yeah,
and then I'm going to taste that. I'm going to go, ooh, that's not a brown ale. I don't like that. If you put it in front of me and go, here, have a lager, I'm going to look at you and go, where's the light yellow urine sample colored thing that I normally drink?
Yep.
So that's my criticism.
All right. That's
so. Do you know why So it's the ingredients that make it a different color. The process, if I read you right, the process is exactly the same.
You're taking barley and you create the malt and the darkness that it has to do with you, how you roast it. It's not unlike coffee. You know, if you roast it more, it's going to get a darker malt. It's different strains of things, but it's mostly the roasting.
That's very nice though.
Yeah.
So I hope out there, dear listener, I want you to know it's very tasty. I just challenge, brother of the pod. I just challenge your naming system. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah, well, it's funny because he does the numbers and he does, you know, a lot of people come up with names for this stuff, but I guess if you're really doing it, it's just too tiring.
It's like when they do those softies. Have you ever drunk, what's it called? Crystal Cola? Which tastes like Coca-Cola, but it's clear.
I'm sure we've talked about this before. I have a clear beer. Miller Clear beer from when the clear craze was all over the place.
Yeah, I
have this. It's Miller made this beer and it's clear and it just tastes like beer.
I'm going to make a legitimate point. They always say that you eat with your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the really good chefs, the expensive restaurants, it's not just the flavor, it's the presentation. I think it's the same too for me with, and part of it is perhaps my own stereotypical way of looking at things. Things have to be called certain things for them to get a, you know,
yeah,
for me, you know, I don't want clear beer.
Well, I mean, we've established before if you like your classic ales, and so even, you know, your IPAs and stuff, that's not really your thing anyway. But that's the thing is all bets are off now. Like a black lager, I don't even know if it was ever like, I'm sure people did it, you know, in Germany 150 years ago. But now it's everybody kind of going for something new. And this is one of the fast, I'm sure we're talking about things we've talked about before.
Whatever.
But like the brewery, they're in a real weird spot now where everybody wants to try something new. And so if you actually have a tried and true, good quality craft brewed beer, you can't keep it up. Like, so Sam Adams is doing this advertising campaign. Listen, the fact is Sam Adams is a really good beer.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and that's a lager, by the way, a browner. It's not urine colored, as you would say.
It's not dark, my dear lager.
But they find themselves competing uphill because everybody wants to try something that came out yesterday and they can't find somewhere. And there's this whole community of people who trade beers online and who like drive across the country to go some microbrewery and wait in line to get beer. This is place up Farm Hill in Vermont that apparently every single day people are in line there by like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah,
because they want to get,
we have talked about
their stuff. And part of it is hype, you know, like there's a lot of people can make a lot of good food with, you know, a lot of good beer, just like a lot of people can make good food.
Is it hype or is it gimmick?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not gimmick in that.
See, your crystal beer, your clear crystal beer is gimmick.
And there's some beers sometimes I think are like Dogfish Head, which is local Delaware,
and there's this place.
There's some beers that I often think are gimmick, but he does a really good job with the guy who runs it. I forget his name at the moment, but they make some good stuff. But some of it is a little weird. Like he grabs these old historical recipes for things that are like made with honey and this, that, and the other thing. And they're quite good, but I would rather have straight ahead beer ingredients, maybe in new combinations.
I do want to say this. I'm going to say this straight to your brother. Because again, it's what's it called? Black lager?
I think it's a black lager. It's going to be awkward when it turns out that I've got this wrong and I just don't have the piece of paper in front of me to check.
If I gave you a cup.
It's his fault for not texting me.
If I gave you a glass of water that was brown, you wouldn't drink it because you'd think it wasn't right. So why on earth is my beer being given to me the same way?
Yeah.
All right, one book to go. I'm going to play some music and let you talk a little bit.
We have to talk about our new resolutions, unless we want to roll that over.
But. No. Oh, whoops. I'll let you talk about it.
Usually I do the audio. Well, this isn't about the book. So this is the music to Tremé, which is the HBO show from David Simon before he did Show Me a Hero, which was excellent. But I think 4 seasons, I think.
Yeah, that's correct.
And it's supposed to be post-Katrina and the things they went through. And then it became about the elections and a bunch of other things in there. But it's a series. It was entertaining. It had good music. It was not one of the best David Simon series. It wasn't really...
Not The Wire.
Exactly.
Not Homicide, Life on the Streets.
But it was people, a lot of people said it was basically like a love letter. People who are really in love with New Orleans, like they, you know, they want to find any reason to sort of help it by like talking about it and having people excited about it. And this was a little bit like that. Like, I think he felt like, listen, you know, I love this place. I want to do what I can to sort of make people aware of the great music, the food, the great culture and all that. And so he put together the series. Very good. And the music was fantastic. I mean, like, you could watch it just for the music, because there's always, you know, some songs and different type of varieties of things done in each episode. And the discussion of food is fascinating. David Chang appears in it because one of the people who's a chef in the story in New Orleans, leave New Orleans, as a lot of people did, to go work up at David Chang's restaurant in New York City. Also part of the story, David Chang is now here in Washington, D.C. with a new restaurant, Momofuku, MMDC, whatever the heck it is. And so it was part of the wave of great food stuff.
All right. Anyway. So the reason we're talking about Treme, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, not Treme, which is a region, you know, an area within New Orleans.
One of the reasons we're talking about that, the TV show is discussed in a book written by a friend of mine, and I'm going to go. We're only going to touch on this book for a minute. He's going to get angry, but as I keep saying to him, don't worry, we're going to have you on the show for a whole episode. That's one of our resolutions. That's our group resolution, is to have you on our show. Friend of mine called Bernie Cook. He is a professor in media studies at Georgetown University. He is originally a New Orleans resident. He wrote a book and published it last year called Flood of Images. And what it did was it analyzed everything that appeared on TV on TV and to a lesser extent film from TV coverage of Hurricane Katrina all the way through to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, the rebuilding, all that kind of stuff. What Bernie Cook did was he looked at everything and attempted to size up how accurate a reflection it was of what really occurred, and how it's also to demonstrate, especially the first third of the book, which analyzes the TV news coverage of a network, NBC, CNN, and Fox, about how, and it was fascinating for someone like me who watches TV all the time, to really see how TV news can shape the story in so many subtle ways. Not just by what the anchor says, but in how they misuse, misrepresent images, how they can point the camera one way and also have a voiceover saying something that, even though the voiceover and what the camera is looking at aren't really related, how corrupt is the wrong word, but how, and undermining is the wrong word, because I'm not sure it's always intentional, but how powerful the image is, and how, if it's not used correctly, can really give a misrepresentation of what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
About a third of the book is him just analyzing hours of CNN, Fox, and NBC coverage, and listening and writing back whole sections, transcripted sections of what the reporters talked about, and how TV news presented a certain image of New Orleans, which ultimately history has proved is not quite what happened then. But one of the reasons, the last section of the book is Treme. He interviewed David Simon and those guys.
Meaning about the show, right?
About the show. And one of the statements that Bernie Cook makes is, even though Treme is fiction, it's an entertainment show on HBO, in a strange way, the attention to detail, how they wrote it, it at times is a more accurate, a piece of fiction is a more accurate reflection of some of the events during and after Hurricane Katrina than some of the straight news footage that came out.
Sure.
And so that was one of the reasons that I know you'd seen that show and you've just said, oh, it's very entertaining, the music's great. But in an interesting way, my good friend Bernie Cook establishes, if you read the book, that yes, Treme, and there are sections.
It's a more accurate portrait of the situation than that's because it has the opportunity to deliberate and do this. I mean, I don't want to ruin everything, Bernie, just so you know, the main reason we haven't gotten to get you on.
Because we're having you on the show.
Well, because we haven't done it yet is because I haven't gotten to read your book. And it's going to be real awkward for me to sit at a table with you and not talk about it.
You will be on in 2016.
I've seen the thing because the fact that I had seen Treme, that would be what I could bring to the table. I don't want to, because these are really interesting themes, I don't want to
no.
do them here and take away from the fact that it'd be much more interesting to do them.
No, we're going to do it when Bernie comes on. But one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it in the show is the book is like 400 pages long, and it took me like 9 weeks. It took me like 10 weeks to read. Yeah. So I'm shouting out now because I don't want people to think he just read like four books. So they're the four books on this show that I talked about.
Yeah, well, you told me before you read some other books.
We read a couple of others that we did on an older show. So that's our resolutions for 2015.
Yeah, we spent more time talking about it, but so maybe we could just briefly talk about our resolutions for the new year. Let me do mine first.
Okay, go for it.
Relatively simple, and I think yours will be more entertaining to talk about. This year I'm going to be drinking tea, more tea, and trying out different types of tea, because there's such a wide range of teas out there in the world. Why is that funny?
I drink about 6 cups of tea a day.
Yeah, but you're
now making this your New Year's resolution.
Yeah, yeah.
You're dressing it up with all.
What kind of tea do you drink? Just a tea bag, right? Like a Lipton.
PG tips.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. A particular. So
some Earl Grey.
The point of this one exercise is to sample a wide range of different teas to know the whole roll. Now, all that said, pretty funny. I'm having the discussion with you and your mom, as you would say, and I felt a little awkward talking about like teas because obviously the folks who come from in, on the other hand, right?
We don't know, do not.
I don't mean this to cast any aspersions, but the people who are closest to a product oftentimes. British tea is a classic British tea. There's not a lot of green tea drinking or white tea drinking or herbal tea drinking that's coming out of Britain. So who knows? Maybe I can add something to the mix. In any event,
if you try to give me clear tea, I'm going to go, yeah, that's not really
I'm
tea.
Still going to be drinking my regular coffee on a regular basis, but I'm going to be mixing in a bunch of teas. Of course, lose like quality, not like the fanciest things ever, but some sort of loose leaf teas that are a little nicer and be able to try it out and I'll hopefully bring something to bear. And I think it'll make for a good podcast a year from now because it'll be easy enough to sample a bunch of teas in a podcast.
That's actually very true.
Yeah.
All right, my resolution. So we have the show's resolution, which is to have our friend Bernie Cook on.
It really shouldn't be that hard, but no. We'll figure it out.
Eric's resolution is to become a tea expert.
Mm-hmm.
My resolution is I had one, and then I suddenly realized this could be very difficult, so I've actually thrown in another one. So I've got two.
Okay.
They all fall under one theme.
All right.
I'm going to – some friends of mine have a dog. They've not trained the dog. It just runs wild.
How old is it?
It's about a year now.
Okay.
I'm going to attempt, and I will record some of my attempts. I'm going to YouTube some videos, and I'm going to attempt to try and instigate some sort of control over the dog. And so every couple of months, I will record myself working with the dog. We'll play it back and we'll have a laugh.
No bad doggies.
No, I'm going to try and teach a dog to sit and to heal. So I know it doesn't sound like much, but this dog's out of control. It don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. It just runs around.
No, sitting and healing. You're the key.
Sitting
key
and healing.
What about stay? Are you going to do stay?
A little that sort of thing. Like I'm not going to teach it to.
Yeah, yeah. Roll over.
Yeah,
shake.
I'm not doing any of that. You want
utilitarian commands.
They're basically commands linked to don't do the toilet in the house. So I'm going to do it.
Sit, stay, and heal.
So I'll use the our outside broadcast recorder, and I'll record some of my efforts working with the dog. I'm also going to teach.
Is that the hard one, or is it the?
I don't know. I'll let you know at the end of the year which was the hard one. I'm also now going to teach someone how to drive stick shift.
Okay, well that's easier.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens.
I mean, listen, a dog. I mean, like a person. If you're teaching somebody to drive stick and at some point they can't get it, is no chance it's the teacher's fault. Because you can teach yourself to drive a stick, right? I mean, like you just futz around with it until you figure it out. And so if you – that's no failure on your part if it doesn't work out for the person.
So my resolution to sum up
– What's the age of the person who's good to teach?
The teenager.
Okay.
So I'm going to become to see what kind of a domestic life instructor I am. A year from now, will I be successful where someone can go, hey, you've just got a dog? You need to call Zeph from the Atlantic Voice.
You're borderline opening the door for a whole nother conversation, but we're not going to go there today.
Well, there you go, because I do things that I know will make for good podcast entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my resolutions for 2016.
Yeah, I think you'll be able to be quite successful in the stick one, The dogs are tough. I mean, some dogs, they don't take it.
You know? Well, we'll soon find out.
Yeah.
I've been watching YouTube videos, but we'll get into all that in our resolution show. We'll have some live action reports during the year when there's nothing else going on. But those are my resolutions. So we've got tea, and then we've got domestic life instruction.
Yeah.
There are two resolutions. I think that's it for this show, right?
I think it is.
I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.